Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And we're here helping you focus on the Constitution. More importantly, what we're going through right now is the evolution of our failed government, or from the revolution, how we evolved from the Confederation or the Association into the Confederation. And under the Confederation, there were just so many problems. And as a matter of fact, welcome back, Sean. We kind of brought this up where there has been a lack in any of the formal documents to even point to the regional conflict of the Shay Rebellion. Now, I do know that there is a growing level of misinformation, and there's sources that are just, this isn't just about the Shay Rebellion. This is the truth. What happened and why it happened, we're giving you the truth. Because as we talked a little bit about the Shay Rebellion, or the lack thereof, as viewed by these men from New York, Virginia, Carolinas, and so forth. I mean, you know, anything south of New York is far removed from what was going on in Massachusetts with the Shay Rebellion. Far removed. And they looked at, you know, hey, that's your state problem. You got a state problem there. And the problem kind of persisted going into the Constitutional Convention, because that's where everybody started realizing that these small northern states were did not have a lot of money. They were strapped, or they were, you know, I would just say strapped hard without cash. They were just getting by. And now they're going to be creating a government that is actually going to have the power to tax and force taxation. Well, even before that happened, the Shay's Rebellion came along, because Massachusetts, understanding, and I'll even just say this, that the government had been probably occupied by good people saying, hey, we have an obligation here. We need to actually pay this debt back, and so we're going to have to raise taxes, and we know it's going to hurt. Well, as we kind of talked about before, this paradigm of the people of Massachusetts, you know, being holier than thou, you know, they didn't like the fact that their government tried to be holier than them in holding them accountable. Welcome back, Sean. I'm not sure if you're muted or not, but okay, great. You're back. And so the other level of information that Tammy and I started covering going into this is another campaign of misinformation. I'm not here taking sides with any of these myopic organizations that are trying to get you to think, you know, it was about this, the lack of being able to control insurrections. To me, I don't know the group or the source that's driving the Shay Rebellion and this necessary centralized power of coming in and policing states, but it sure seems, because this is the first time I've heard that the Shay Rebellion was that important. First time it's actually bubbled up to where it's gotten to me. So this is new, but the other thing that has been bubbling up for years and years and years has been the Constitutional Convention. This is the season for the Constitutional Convention. So it's only apropos that we kind of talk about this. And as a matter of fact, it's important that we clearly lay it all on the table. The fact is that the paradigm of so many people have basically convinced everybody else that this is a binary conversation. In other words, removing actually anything that's really going to solve the problem, we only have two options. We either convene a convention or we don't convene a convention. Because those who are anti-convention have really no plan. those who are opposing the Article 5 convention, or what I call the con-con, what everybody calls the con-con, and I do, so being engaged in this, so let me give you this background, Sean, because some of this stuff you may not know the nuances. The Article 5 convention, or the Convention of States organization, started getting called in a derogatory way a con-con, or the Constitutional Convention folks, people who want a Constitutional Convention. Because when you place that kind of context, people realize that, hey, they could, and in all rightfully, you know, the powers that are available to them, the potter, right, the clay and the potter's hand, have the ability to rewrite the Constitution in that convention. Well, they're trying to play the semantics to say, ah, we only want an Article 5 convention of states, not a constitutional convention. And I had to correct these people when I get to deal with them that's representing the – and so the Convention of State folks, by the way, they changed their name to the Convention of States Action. That's what they go by, even though their domain is still conventionofstates.com. And that, I find that interesting that they're a .com, not a .org. But, you know, maybe they have good Merck and stuff. But anyway, the point is this, is that when you look at a process that is in the Constitution, such as, let's just say, elections. Are elections constitutional? Well, yeah, the choosing of the electors is a constitutional process. So we could call it the constitutional choosing of the electors. In Article 5, there are two ways to amend the Constitution. There is the congressional path, where Congress can submit amendments to the Constitution, so that's the congressional path. And then there is the state's path, where the states can form a constitutional convention. Now, hold on, there's those terms again. You shouldn't be using those terms, but technically, is the convention, and I'm just going to ask you, am I going out on a limb to say that the convention that the states will send delegates to is in the Constitution? Is that true?
Yes.
So if I said that that's a constitutional, in other words, it is derived under the powers of the Constitution, so it is a constitutional convention, that makes sense, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So don't play semantics with me, because I can whip up semantics too. And bottom line, that convention is constitutional. It's a constitutional convention. And they don't like the fact that that actually can be associated to that. Because then it helps the opponents, their opponents, mislead everybody, because it's a constitutional convention, it's going to be a runaway convention. Have you heard that?
I have heard that.
Okay, so the John Birch Society bit into this a long, long time ago. And they've been using this, it's a runaway convention, it's going to be a runaway convention. The first one was runaway, this one will be a runaway. Now, hold on here. I have gone out of my way to prove that the runaway convention is a misnomer. It is propaganda. That is deceit and lies by the John Birch Society. Well, hold on here. They make the argument. Wow, that's Murphy. Forgive me. So they make the argument, and he's gonna demise. It's his time for his beefy treat. So the John Birch Society makes the argument that because they went and the commissions came from each state directing their delegates to do very specific things according to them, and according to them, what they did in that convention violated their commissions. In other words, this is the premise of the runaway convention. So therefore, what we're doing now by going through these commissions is literally laying out how they didn't violate their commission. What was their commission? So we just read Connecticut. And so at this point, what we're going to do is we're going to actually help me out here. we're going to summarize what we just covered because it's worth, because I don't want to keep you behind. So my challenge at this point in time is to, by covering these authorizing acts or the acts authorizing the allegation of the election of delegates going to the Constitutional Convention, we want to cover how many states had tight restrictions or any kind of restrictions on their delegates to basically say, they did violate their commission because they were told that they could only do these things, that they were not given a blank check. So let's look at how they stipulated this. So what we covered in Connecticut, and something that I want to point out to you because it's very important, is if you look in the third line underneath, or I should say like the third paragraph, underneath the Connecticut Act electing and empowering delegates. And folks, this document is on the Academic Source Documents page, so you can pull this in and read this. That third paragraph states this: be it enacted by the governor, council, and representatives in what? In general court and by authority of the same. So hold on here. Is this the legislature or is this the court? It's both. Back in many of the states, some states didn't have a judiciary. Their legislature actually fulfilled, just like Continental Congress, fulfilled the functions of the fundamental court or the fundamental rulings of being the Supreme Court of the state. Why? Because they were the sovereigns. They were the ones that created the law. Surely they should know. Surely they should understand the laws that they created. Why have a judiciary? Why, you know, create bigger government? Well, under this new constitution, there's these protections and those types of things. So anyway, the next part is highlighted, and this is the part that has to be emphasized. As shall, okay, so let me go to the beginning of this. And in case of sickness or accident, such as one or more of them as shall actually attend the said convention, is and are hereby authorized and empowered to represent this state therein and to confer with such delegates appointed by the several states for the purposes mentioned in the said act of Congress, quote, or they're not quoting, they're not using quotes, but they're kind of encapsulating, that may be present and duly empowered to act in said convention and discuss upon such alterations and provisions agreeable to the general principles of republican government, as they shall think proper to render the federal constitution adequate to the exigencies of government and the preservation of the union. What kind of restrictions did they just impose upon the delegates of Connecticut?
Not very many.
No, as a matter of fact, it was like a blank check. Go work with these guys and consider anything and everything that is going to, you know, save the union and deal with the exigencies of government that we're facing right now. They didn't say anything to say, just come back with some amendments. They didn't say, do not change the Articles of Confederation. Right? There's no restrictions. To me, that's a blank check. Okay, so now you've caught up to where we're at. Because the whole point, you know, as I go through these things, I understand these counter arguments out there, you know, that are being pitched by these different entities, i.e. the, you know, when I look at the Article 5 season, there's two sides to this. There's the conventionites and the anti-conventionites. You know, the those for, those against. That's what it is. And they've convinced everybody that this is a binary conversation. And as far as I'm concerned, we're proving that it really isn't. That what they've done is they've trapped us in the only way we can fix this is either by a convention or not by a convention. But the people that are saying, well, you can't have a convention, has no actual solution. They cannot map out how all of these things of government and all these violations get purged from the existing government. Oh, well, they say, well, you've got to hold them to their oath. Well, you hear, I've been saying that for years, long before they started bringing that up, long before. That didn't become their mantra until, I think, 2018, 2019. I've been bringing that up for years regarding Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, holding them accountable, not just holding them to their oath, but actually removing and banning them. And on top of that, when we look at the solution being republic review, in other words, auditing and identifying every violation, they don't talk about that. Nor, and then they say, oh, well, we want to just nullify the laws. Well, they're not telling you what the process is to that, because as I've told you, the nullification is the very final expunging of a law. How do you get there? You have to interpose. And we're proving this. But and we proved this just last month, remember? As we went through those five critical documents of the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions and so forth. So, anywho, as we kind of look at the next state, now let's see what happens with Delaware. Now, is Delaware acting as a court? This is whereas the General Assembly, so they don't identify themselves, and there's a good, I'd have to actually look at the structure of each of the states as we look at these documents, or, you know, these acts, because that helps you understand what framework of government we're dealing with. Maybe Delaware actually had a judiciary, where Connecticut may not have had a judiciary. But jumping down, what we want to do is kind of read Section 1, because there's some green and some red, and then Section 2. So, Sean, let's go ahead and read Section 1 with both the green, all of it, from the top to the bottom, through the yellow. Thank you.
Be it therefore enacted by the General Assembly of Delaware that George Reed, Gunning Bedford, John Dickinson, Richard Bassett, and Jacob Broome, Esquires, are hereby appointed deputies from this state to meet in the convention of the deputies of other states, to be held at the city of Philadelphia on the second day of May next, and the said George Reed, Gunning Bedford, John Dickinson, Richard Bassett and Jacob Broome, Esquires, or any three of them, are hereby constituted and appointed deputies from this state, with powers to meet such deputies as may be appointed and authorized by the other states, to assemble in the said convention at the city of aforesaid, and to join with them in devising, deliberating on, and discussing such alterations and further provisions as may be necessary to render the federal constitution adequate to the exigencies of the union, and in reporting such act or acts for that purpose to United States and Congress assembled as when agreed to by them and duly confirmed by the several states may effectually provide for the same. So always and provided that such alterations or further provisions or any of them do not extend to that part of the fifth article of the Confederation of the said states, finally ratified on the first day of March in the year 1781, which declares that, quote, in determining questions in the United States and Congress assemble, each state shall have one vote.
Okay, so they kind of had this little qualification to make sure that in Congress, each state had its equality, right? That when it came down to any questions, you know, in Congress to determine something, that each state had equal voting power, one vote each, right? So that was the quality. So this is one of the very few states that actually had a qualification that, hey, we want you to go there and we want you to discuss liberally and freely, deliberating and discussing such alterations and further provisions as may be necessary to render this federal constitution adequate to the exigencies of the union. But we don't want you to change that one part, because we want to make sure that our sovereignty is protected, because these big states were going to gobble us up. they already started expressing this concern over the larger states and taking powers that, you know, would basically take their sovereignty away. So when we look at this right here, is this a, you know, when we, and actually understanding what the byproduct of the convention was, the Constitution, did the Constitution not protect in the Senate? Because they created a bicameral legislative body instead of a cameral, a unicameral. In other words, there were two bodies. And so for something to pass a bill, it still required a majority of the states, because each state got one vote. So they had the protection of what they were asking for in that bicameral structure. Do you not agree?
I agree, sir.
Okay, so they did this, delegates of Delaware, because when we go through the convention, I'm going to point out how these guys were constantly concerned if they were acting outside of the commission that they were given, and how they kind of, you know, looked at what they were doing and going, look, you know, we are dealing with the exigencies of the union. One of the things that came out of the convention is there was no way to just amend the, you know, the Articles of Confederation. It literally required, because there were so many different problems. And the reason why there were so many different problems was they wanted to improve on checks and balances, and they literally changed the structure of government from a single magistrate into three separate branches. And it, to be representative, that the president would be representative of the Electoral College, and that the Congress would be representative of the people of the states, as well as the state legislature, as bicameral. Unfortunately, they failed with representation regarding the Supreme Court, the judiciary, and which is why the judiciary is really representative of the Ivy Tower, you know, legal school education system, which is why they, you know, have constantly reached out to broader and broader law and, you know, redefining the Constitution and so many different perversions and problems. But nevertheless, what I am seeing here was some stipulations. Yes, there were stipulations, but the ultimate outcome of what they provided, because it didn't force the state of Delaware to abandon the Articles of Confederation. They offered a new form of government that they felt actually dealt with and fixed all of the exigencies. And so they basically provided this brand new, you know, let's kick, you know, not only let's kick the tires, this was superior. As they argued, this was so superior in so many different ways. Even anti-federalists like James Monroe, just on the oath itself, because there was no oath to the Articles of Confederation. That wasn't even in any of the amendments. These guys really brainstormed and created, just through the insights of the divine hand of providence, they created a government that was fit for him, for the people or his children to be governed by. Only time in the history of the world did he do this, independently and separately from his prophets and, you know, his people. He created a government for all people to be able to govern themselves and maintain liberty. Just an amazing thing. Absolutely amazing. An extension of his love to all the people of the earth. Interesting. So, okay, so the Delaware Convention, they didn't get it there. They didn't have this problem. And Section 2, be it enacted that in case any of the said deputies hereby nominated shall happen to die or to resign his or their appointment, the president or commander-in-chief, with the advice of the Privy Council and the recess of the General Assembly, is hereby authorized to supply such vacancies. In other words, to basically make sure somebody else was going to be selected to fill that seat so that they would have adequate representation of delegates in the Constitutional Convention. So obviously we're out of time for this segment for today. And so we're going to go into a short break. And with that, we will come back and we're going to dive into the good state of Georgia, and let's see how they constrain them. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, with that, we're going to dive into Georgia and the electing and empowering of delegates on the 10th of February, 1787. And so let's see how Georgia gives instruction or what commission they give to their delegates. So let's go ahead, because the only point that I'm trying to point out as we hit each of these is this state identifying, is the state legislature identifying themselves as the grand poobah of the law? In other words, the Supreme Court, the grand court. Not in this case, but they did in Connecticut. So one out of three so far. And so go ahead and just read that one paragraph.
Be it ordained by the representatives of the freemen of the state of Georgia in General Assembly, met and by the authority of the same, that William Few, Abraham Baldwin, William Pierce, George Walton, William Houston, and Nathaniel Pendleton, Esquires, be, and they are hereby appointed commissioners, who, or any two or more of them, are hereby authorized as deputies from this state, to meet such deputies as may be appointed and authorized by other states, to assemble in convention at Philadelphia, and to join with them in devising and discussing all such alterations and farther provisions as may be necessary to render the federal constitution adequate to the exigencies of the Union, and in reporting such an act for that purpose to the United States and Congress assembled, as when agreed to by them and duly confirmed by the several states, will effectually provide for the same. In case of the death of any of said deputies or of their declining their appointments, the executive are hereby authorized to supply such vacancies.
Okay, so no reservations here. And the hint is the yellow highlights will identify that there's some restrictions. And actually, in all three states so far, the requirement for unanimity, in other words, the requirement that we would require all 13 states to agree to an amendment or to agree to changes, were not something they wanted to keep. Nobody so far said, yeah, let's keep that crappy idea, because as long as that threshold is maintained, there was no hope for the Union. Anybody that literally wanted to maintain that type of unanimity, in other words, requiring 100% buy-in by all the states for any change to occur, was basically granting the kiss of death to the Constitution and the general government of the Union, that the Union would fail, period. So as we go through this, don't be surprised which is the state that gives this, I'll just say, gives their commissioners that kiss of death, that basically says, whatever you do when you go in there, you do not get rid of that. So let's go into Massachusetts. Here we go. So with Massachusetts, we kind of have this large-bodied, you know, presentation. This was done both the 7th of March and the 22nd of February, I think finalized on the 7th. And so the Senate, actually, if you go through this, created on the 9th of March extra provisions to ensure, because they actually had a bicameral legislative body. They had a House of Representatives, or I think it was, you know, it was all in Faneuil Hall, and I don't know how they called themselves, but they had two, a lower and an upper body. So, and I think the Senate was the upper body, but I don't think that they called themselves the House of Representatives. Anyway, so let's go ahead. And it says the House substitute of March 7th for the resolution of 22 February. So let's go ahead and kind of read through it from that point through so that we can kind of see the final output from the Senate on the 9th. Go ahead.
Where the green is, right?
Yeah, actually just start with the whereas Congress did on, because they're calling their Congress or their legislature, right. Congress. Go ahead, yeah.
Whereas Congress did on the 21st day of February 1787 resolve that in the opinion of Congress it is expedient that on the second Monday in May next, a convention of delegates who shall have been appointed by the several states to be held in Philadelphia for the sole and express purpose of revising the Articles of Confederation and reporting to Congress and the several legislatures such alterations and provisions therein as shall, when agreed to in Congress and confirmed by the states, render the federal constitution adequate to the exigencies of government and the preservation of the Union.
Okay, so my bad. My reference to Congress was misreading this. Actually, this was the House, and referring Congress, they're talking about Continental Congress. Okay, so that's Congress was the one that sent out on the 21st day, and so on the 7th, they created this resolution in response to, and the 9th was sealing the deal, I think, in the Senate. So keep going with the next paragraphs. Go ahead.
And whereas the legislature of this Commonwealth did on the third day of this present month elect the Honorable Francis Dana, Elbridge Gerry, Nathaniel Gorham, Rufus King, and Caleb Strong Esquires, delegates or any three of them to attend and represent this Commonwealth at the aforesaid convention for the sole and express purpose mentioned in the aforesaid resolve of Congress. Resolved that His Excellency the Governor be and he hereby is requested to grant to the said Francis Dana Eldridge Gerry Nathaniel Gorham Rufus King and Caleb Strong Esquires a commission agreeably to said resolution of Congress. Continue.
Oh, no. So actually, it's Gary, not Jerry. I know that it looks like that, but they back in those days he was pronounced Eldridge Gerry. But that all being said, because that was the guy that they dubbed gerrymandering.
Right. That's why I was.
Yeah. I know that it's actually should be gerrymandering, but right. Really, what Eldridge Gerry did was he only did what Patrick Henry did in the very beginning of the devising of congressional districts and so forth in playing with the boundaries to ensure certain types of representation were going in, you know, in other words, Republican or Democrat. They were doing that in Virginia before Gerry actually tried to play that much later. It was considerably later. I think Patrick Henry by that point in time died, because I think he died before the turn of the century. And I don't think Gerry was caught or was accused of political inference into the changing of the boundaries to create a preference, you know, in a particular direction, i.e. Federalist, Republican, what have you. Because I believe this all happened after the election of Thomas Jefferson, because they successfully unseated Federalists out of many of the states where the Republicans, you know, challenged and got duly elected in Congress, enough so that gave Jefferson the needed support. Marginal what it is, but gave him the needed support from both the federal level as well as the state level. So anyway, so here's what the Senate does, though. Now let's read this.
Senate amendment to the House substitute 9 March, and it is further resolved that the said delegates on the part of this Commonwealth be, and they are hereby instructed, not to accede to any alterations or additions that may be proposed to be made in the present Articles of Confederation, which may appear to them not to consist with the true Republican spirit and genius of the said Confederation, and particularly that they by no means interfere with the fifth of the said articles, which provides, quote, for the annual election of delegates in Congress with a power reserved to each state to recall its delegates or any of them within a year and to send others in their stead for the remainder of the year, and which also provides that no person shall be capable of being a delegate for more than 3 years in any term of 6 years, or being a delegate shall be capable of holding any office in the United States for which he or any other for his benefit receives any salary, fees, or emolument of any kind. Order that the Secretary serve the aforenamed delegates severally and such others as may hereafter be appointed in their stead with an attested copy of the last foregoing resolve.
Okay, so they actually had some stipulations or some reservations, and they did not give the same kind of language to go and fix the exigencies of the Union. All they did was they said, we're okay with them going forward. Because if you read in the green, the House basically said, such alterations provisions therein as shall, when agreed to in Congress and confirmed by the states, render the federal Constitution adequate to the exigencies. So that's where the blank check was. But the Senate wanted to make sure that two things were maintained. That first off, that they would not agree or cede to any of the alterations that would actually change the what they would call that part of Article 5, quote, for the annual election. So they were more concerned about having the ability to get rid of a person in Congress, a representative in Congress, on a yearly basis instead of every other year or 3 years or what have you. And then they also pointed out that no person shall be capable of being a delegate for more than 3 years in any term of 6 years. So in other words, kind of a term limit based on a 6-year period of time. So you could be a delegate for 3 years, then you have to come home and stay out of government for 3 years, then you can go back again for 3 years and keep that rotation. So it was kind of like a term limits, but it wasn't, if that makes sense. So that's what they wanted to protect, and that was it. When we go through the ratification debates, we actually hear where they mumble and grumble about this whole concept of, you know, changing to 2 years and the Senate be 6 years. And, oh, my gosh, the world was coming to an end. They wanted to maintain this complete fluidity of getting rid of their people. And as they argued in the ratification debates, we'll actually see how, you know, they were, you know, I don't want to say they were called fools or anything, but I think that the reasoning that was presented changed enough hearts and minds of the people to say, that's not a matter that I would not ratify this Constitution because of its changes of the election process of our representation in Congress. So, okay, now we get into Maryland. So let's go ahead and read that paragraph that Maryland enacted. Go ahead.
An act for the appointment of and conferring powers in deputies from this state to the federal convention. Be it enacted by the General Assembly of Maryland that the Honorable James McHenry Daniel of St. Thomas, Jennifer, Daniel Carroll, John Francis Mercer, and Luther Martin Esquires be appointed and authorized on behalf of this state to meet such deputies as may be appointed and authorized by any other of the United States to assemble in convention at Philadelphia for the purpose of revising the federal system, and to join with them in considering such alterations and further provisions that may be necessary to render the federal Constitution adequate to the exigencies of the Union, and in reporting such an act for that purpose to the United States and Congress assembled, as when agreed to by them and duly confirmed by the several states, will effectually provide for the same, and the said deputies or such of them as shall attend the said convention shall have full power to represent this state for the purposes aforesaid. And the said deputies are hereby directed to report the proceedings of the said convention and any act agreed to therein to the next session of the General Assembly of this state.
Okay, so I don't see any reservations at all. I would have highlighted it with yellow, so I'm not hiding anything here. So here's another state. Now, we've just read through four states. Two had reservations, and two didn't. And the reservations that they were having were not real deal breakers, other than I would say Massachusetts was, you know, they felt that, you know, they were defied. It's almost like you came onto their under their property and kicked their dog. How dare you? You know?
That's true.
So, because they really wanted that level of control. But in understanding that you're going to have a general government, you can't have, you know, federal elections that, you know, in one state are done every year. So it had to be, you know, it had to be uniform. The elections and the term limits, or I should say the terms of service and so forth, they had to all be uniform. And Massachusetts was the only state that wanted to maintain that idea, that paradigm. The only state, because going through the ratification debates, I can't recall any other state making political hay, saying, oh, this is a deal breaker. We don't need these people. Who do they think they are, kind of thing? I mean, anyway. All right, so that was Massachusetts. Now let's do Maryland. Or hold on. We just did Maryland. It's North Carolina. So that's five states, two with reservations, three without. So maybe Maryland, as the sixth state, might have it, but I don't see the yellow text, but let's go. Go ahead and just read that one paragraph with the green text.
Okay, I just read this part. We already did Maryland.
Oh, I'm sorry, North Carolina. My bad. I said
Act authorizing the election of delegates, 6 January 1787. An act for appointing deputies from the state to a convention proposed to be held in the city of Philadelphia in May next for the purpose of revising the federal constitution. Whereas in the formation of the federal compact, which frames the bond of union of American states, it was not possible in the infant state of our republics to devise a system which in the course of time and experience would not manifest imperfections that it would be necessary to reform. And whereas the limited powers which by the Articles of Confederation are vested in the Congress of the United States have been found far inadequate to the enlarged purposes which they were intended to produce. And whereas Congress hath by repeated and most urgent representations endeavored to awaken this and the other states of the Union to a sense of the truly critical and alarming situation into which they must be unavoidably cast, unless measures are forthwith taken to enlarge the powers of Congress, that they may thereby be enabled to avert the dangers which threaten our existence as a free and independent people. And whereas the state has been ever desirous to act upon the enlarged system of the general good of the United States, without bounding its views to the narrow and selfish object of partial convenience, and has been at all times ready to make every concession to the safety and happiness of the whole, which justice and sound policy could vindicate.
Okay, so right there, let me just take a quick second. It sure sounds like they're rebuking what the states have done and how some of the states are trying to maintain this inept and impotent confederation and Articles of Confederation. I mean, they're really, to me, pointing the finger of judgment out at all these states that want to maintain the status quo. Right? Are you seeing that?
I don't really get the gist of the other states trying to keep it from happening.
But. Well, okay, so let's just look at the history. They've already tried to get eight amendments through. And if you kind of look at, they've talked the fact that they had this infant state. and they tried to devise with a course of experience and imperfections that the necessary to reform. They actually tried 8 times to reform that existing government, and they couldn't get there. And so they, you know, the rest, I mean, right here, that this first paragraph kind of gives you the history of we're in this situation because the inadequacies that, you know, are within this Articles of Confederation are being protected because we can't get any changes. And we need these changes. They were basically, you know, supporting these adequate changes necessary to maintain the Union. So anyway, now they get into this declaration, one, and then two. So let's go ahead and go through these declarations.
And be it further enacted that in the case of death or resignation of any kind of any of the said deputies or of their declining their appointment.
So you're reading the second declaration. Read the first one first. The green. Because we stopped at the end.
Okay. Be it therefore enacted by the General Assembly of the State of North Carolina and by the authority of the same, that 5 commissioners be appointed by joint ballot of both houses of assembly, who or any 3 of them are hereby authorized as deputies from this state to meet at Philadelphia on the first day of May next, and then and there to meet and confer with such deputies as may be appointed by the other states for similar purposes, and with them to discuss and decide upon the most effectual means to remove the defects of our federal union and to procure the enlarged purpose which it was intended to effect, and that they report such an act to the General Assembly of the state as when agreed to by them will effectually provide for the same. Okay. And be it further enacted that in the case of death or resignation of any of said deputies or declining appointments, His Excellency the Governor for the time being is hereby authorized to supply such vacancies, and the Governor is required to transmit forthwith a copy of this act to the United States in Congress assembled and to the executives of each of the states in the Union.
Okay, so interestingly enough, they actually go out, and the language is devise, decide. In other words, go out and create and do. Don't just come back with, you know, this stonewalling of, well, we came up with these ideas. What do you think about these? Because the runaway state argument is that that's what really should have happened. They really should have maybe come back with maybe an amendment. The reality is this, and the men in the delegation, or I should say in the Constitutional Convention, knew that if they came back with a rewriting or a redevising of the Third, Fourth, and Eighth Amendments, and, you know, making them far, you know, more powerful and everything else, and they submitted them that way, that they did nothing. In other words, they knew that the one state, Rogue Island, would not allow the changes to occur. Therefore, their hands were tied. They had to change that parameter right there. Had they not changed that, and there's no, right at this point, there has been no reservations to say, we demand you maintain unanimity, that it requires every state in the union to agree. They just wanted to make sure that, what state was it? Massachusetts or Delaware? Whichever state it was that actually said, hey, we want to make sure that we still have at least an equal vote to keep bad laws from, you know, going forward and so forth. They didn't care about the unanimity. They just wanted to make sure that the states maintained its sovereignty. Massachusetts, it was all about the terms of election. There was not one state so far that felt, hey, boy, this requirement of unanimity, boy, we got to have that. That's really working great for us. They all knew. They all knew in that convention, and everybody knew in the union, that as long as Rogue Island was going to be a part of this process moving forward, that they had to take that away. They had to. And so they got criticized for doing that. Because reality is, had they had to maintain that, coming out of the convention to say, this Constitution must be ratified by 100%, what they did was they said those states ratifying this Constitution with nine states will actually form this new Constitution, a new government, leaving to those old states their own confederation so that they can maintain that general body of Congress and so forth to represent them. They weren't trying to create a monopoly government instantly to replace. They were allowing the other state governments to maintain their sovereignty and their problems as they saw fit if they didn't join this union. So I'm just trying to make this point that, you know, it's very deceptive to say, oh, well, that was a change and that was a big change. It was the most necessary change that had to occur, or nothing would have happened, and the Constitutional Convention would have been a bust, and what would have happened, because now we're forming this new government in 1789, that would have created a delay that maybe the new government would have formed if they went back to the drawing boards by the grace of God and was able to meet in the convention one more time to maybe get pretty please can we put in there so that the states would, you know, soften their hearts, whatever. Had we had to go through that delay, remember that the French Revolution occurred in 1790. We owed them a lot of money. And with the outcome of the French Revolution, or I should say the turn of events occurring in 1790, 1791, with Bonaparte arising, there's no doubt in my mind that we would be speaking much differently. As a matter of fact, you'd probably feel very comfortable with it in Louisiana. But we would be speaking much differently in the United States, because there's no doubt in my mind Napoleon wouldn't have cared about going across Europe. He would have cared about coming across the Atlantic and getting his pound of flesh out of this little, you know, strapped, you know, Republican government that, you know, is too good to pay their debt. No doubt in my mind he would have got his pound of flesh out of us. And he would have done so with assistance from probably Spain and England, knowing that England would want their pound of flesh too. So they could have actually divided and conquered us. I'm just here to tell you folks that this Constitutional Convention, what these men did, and what the outcome of that 1787 convention was, clearly a divine hand of providence, intervention and inspiration that literally put this nation from the dangers of peril into a control of its own destiny, where the sky was the limit. And we go through over the rest of the year showing how we prove that and how constantly the avarice and the desires and machinations of nefarious men go literally awry and start subverting and unconstitutionally changing our government in so many different ways. And so thanks for participating, Sean. We'll bring you back on for any go-backs in tomorrow's show. So worry not. Whatever you've got, we'll bring you in first. Thank you so much. I'm J.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.